Been talking about Wham and Mary Ann's background and how it all came together.
Right.
And if you could quick, briefly, Mary Ann's background, and you talked about she had been organizing.
Well, yeah, Mary Ann actually was an actress and a singer.
Really?
And she had her own radio show when she was, I think maybe 15 or 16 years old. And you've met her, haven't you? Mary Ann has a gorgeous, trained voice. It's still quite a, I mean, you can tell when she speaks that she has a voice that's been trained. And she married this man, what was her name? Her name was forgotten, but she married a Hamilton, a man named Norman Hamilton, who was an artist, but also a businessman, and he worked in graphics for forgotten what corporation. But he made they did very well. He was also an alcoholic. They had about 8 kids. And what was I going to tell you about her?
Well, we had talked about, and again, this is what we talked about, but the tape didn't work, was about how she organized something that later became a model for
Amnesty International.
Right.
Yeah, that was in her work. They were trying to save Vietnamese prisoners, and those prisoners were in tiger cages. And that she was the one. I don't know who else found them, but they discovered that they were in tiger cages, and she would get the names of these people, and then they give them to people in this country, and they would write letters back to the South Vietnamese government that was still our government.
Right.
And demand to know what had happened to these people, and because they had the names, then it put the pressure on to get them released. So there were many saved through that, and that's what Amnesty International does. And I asked her specifically, and she said yes, they had not done that until she did it. So she worked with some priests. She was very Catholic. She's not that Catholic anymore, but she was quite Catholic. And she was in Vietnam and met Madame Binh, who was a leader in the North Vietnamese, the communist government, because Mary Ann is much more communist than capitalist, as I am. But she's not a communist. So I had met Mary Ann before, and I think I told you that she had also, on several occasions, and she was on the FBI watch list. She told me one time that she had a deserter in her car, and they were watching her. So when she went out of the driveway, he had to hide in the back seat so they couldn't see him. And then she took him someplace, and he got to Canada. And I think I told you that also happened to me. Not within my car, but that at Southwest State, some of the people that I've worked with in the bookstore, I've forgotten just who it was now, said they wanted to talk to me.
Okay.
And I said, fine. They said, but we want to talk to you after hours. And so then they came and they brought this young man, and he had long hair. And then he took off his hat, and it was a wig. He was wearing a wig. He was also a deserter from the military and said he just couldn't kill anymore. He couldn't do it. And he wanted to go to Canada. And I hadn't the slightest idea. So I called the Quakers, and they were pretty concerned that I was calling them on the telephone, you know.
Okay.
But they told me what to do. And so I took him to the bus, and I think we got him a ticket. I think I gave him $25 or something. And he got a ticket to go up to Duluth or someplace, and then he went to Canada.
Huh.
So that was, I think I told you that Bellows, the president, said at least once a month he had somebody from Marshall call him and tell him that they should fire me because the people in Marshall thought that I led all the, I was behind all the dissent at the college.
Yes, yeah, we talked about that.
So then I, when I saw Mary Ann, when I came up here, I had met her during these years because she was pretty well known. And she didn't remember me too much, but I looked her up. And then we began talking about the fact that there was a nuclear, emphasis on the nuclear buildup at the time. That was in the 80s when I came up here. And so we both said, well, you know, we could do the same thing. We could have another Vietnam on our hands right immediately. The country hasn't changed. The people haven't changed. So we want to start an organization. So we met. She had a group of women that she knew that were also, they were all middle-aged women that had been involved in the anti-war movement. So we called them, she called them, we got them together. We met at dinner once a month and talked about what we were going to do, how we would get this organization going. Nobody had the vaguest idea how to do it. None of us had ever done anything like this before. So then we finally decided that we had to have a full-time staff and an office, and that we needed money. And that's when we decided to use our Christmas card list and write everybody on our Christmas card list a letter, that those people that we felt could give us $100. And we drafted this letter with everybody putting something in on it, in, you know, with a lot of input, asking people for the money. Then we made, people took it and put their own names on it and sent it to the Christmas card list. I don't remember how much money we got. It wasn't gobs, but we got enough to rent an office, and Mary Ann became the first director, and for her to get paid for a couple of weeks. And then we just started. She found this office down on Hennepin, and I was telling somebody, maybe it was you, that we operated like Walter and I did when we were first married. We didn't have a budget for years. We just paid bills. And sometimes we couldn't pay a bill one month and it would have to wait till the next month. And so it was just nip and tuck for a number of years. And that's the way WAM was. We did not have a budget or anything. And then when I got fired from my job, I was working for the boycott, then I had 6 months pay on unemployment. And so I went to work. So there were two of us working there then, and only she was getting paid. So that gave us a big boost. And we just devised our strategy as we went along. But it taught me a lot about organizing. I know a lot now that I didn't know then. For one thing, I like the organic style as opposed to the corporate style. The corporate style of organizing is you decide where you are today, where you want to go, how you're going to get where you want to go, and who does what in order to get there. In organic organizing, that's my expression, you have a vision of what you want to do, and you have a general idea of how you're going to get there, but you just start. And you make mistakes, you don't know how you're going, and it's like this adage, this Russian adage that I love. Remember, pilgrim, there is no path. The path is made by walking. Isn't that beautiful? And so that's what we did. We didn't start off saying we were going to be a women's organization. That just came to us because we wanted to run it ourselves, and we know that when women are involved with men in an endeavor, the men are the ones who make the decisions, and the women let them. They don't argue about it. They've been pretty well socialized, so we didn't want that. So that's what we decided that we would run the organization, and so we did. Everything just happened, step at a time, and we had one big to do over a violent action that was during a demonstration here, and we were in coalition with a group, and they threw a bowling ball through a recruiting office, and that's a violent action. And we had a big to-do about that, and I wasn't very good on it. I did not believe in what they did, but I didn't push my point. And we survived it, but we found out later the people in that group that were provocateurs.
Oh.
The one man in particular was paid by the government.
Oh, to do that.
To do that, to create problems in the peace movement. So, one of the things that happened to us at WAM was that was the issue of abortion. Did I mention that?
Yes, and you were forced to...
We were forced to come up and make a statement about...
You really didn't want to. That was not your issue.
No, we didn't want to, but we did it. And today, and we've all learned, we have one thing, there has never been a power struggle in that organization because we don't have any.
Well, and you've said, and I don't know if it was on tape before or that was one that broke, your media policy is anybody can make a statement.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter who you are.
Right, anybody. Yeah. And what else? And that our programs are emphasized by the people who are concerned about it, a particular issue. And now I'm involved also in this group, Every Church a Peace Church now. And they got some money. And it's funny how when you get money sometimes you think it's going to be good, but it's not. They got a bunch of money. They got $500,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Just recently?
Yeah. And then they hired this woman. And now they want to spend time on a mission statement. And a mission statement and bylaws and that stuff.
They're going after the corporate structure, sounds like.
Yes. And so that, I had talked to a man at St. Jones about that one time, because I got in another group, and they wanted this man, it was an attorney there, and he said, well, I want to know just what we're going to stand for, and we've got to write out a statement as to what, and I got out of the group.
Yeah.
And then I talked to one of the administrators at St. Jones about this, and he said, it's a dead end. He said, you spend so much time on that statement, and then you always ask yourself, well, are we living up to our statement, or are we not? Instead of just saying there's a need, we want to fulfill it, and then just letting it fall as it does. So, anyhow, that Every Church a Peace Church is kind of, it's good, but I'm concerned. Then we had a woman who's on the national board, and she expressed her concern. Also on that, and this is something that's really kind of ticklish, they hired a black woman to be the chairperson of this organization and to direct the money and so forth. And she's afraid it's going to turn into a anti-racism organization, as opposed to emphasis on the nonviolence of Christ. Racism is certainly a factor, but if you just concentrate on that, you just can't do it. And so she's concerned, and it's going to get off the national board, and I don't think we're going to get anybody to do it, because they're having meetings fairly frequently. I would be on the board. I mean, I'm interested, but they're having meetings like you have to go out east every 4 months. I don't want to fly out east every 4 months and attend the meeting and sit in a meeting all day, and that's...
So the half a million was... So this is a national organization.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's a national organization that got the money.
Yeah.
And then they hired somebody, and then they're trying to do this mission statement, and then somehow dictate somehow to the local...
Right.
Here's what you're going to do and why.
You see, and that's not the way it's happened in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we're the strongest group in the country, and we just do what we want to do. We just talk about what we're doing and do it.
Yeah.
And so that's it. Let's see.
Well,
okay, what's next?
We had talked on this other tape that broke about, I just wrote down here, Phil Donahue Show, Seneca Falls.
Yeah.
Memorable protest, but Phil Donahue Show, that was a long time ago. Well, how did that come about? You were on the Phil Donahue Show.
Well, Wham had been in existence about 2 or 3 years, I guess. And there was a, at Seneca Falls, it's actually Romulus, New York, nuclear weapons were stored. They had a big depot there and stored these weapons. And there was, the women all over the country were protesting that, and they had an encampment there. So we decided to send some women from Minnesota to the encampment, and a woman that I'd worked with, and in fact, we hired to organize this thing. So we had 2 busloads of people that went to Seneca Falls. Well, as the time grew closer, I really got worried about it because I thought this could be the end of Wham. We could have so much trouble on this bus trip, just the details. But we lived in tents. And I lived in a tent, and Judy Plank went. She came from Marshall at the time. And while we were there, one of the actions that we did, we chained ourselves to a fence. And a reporter came down from someplace, and she talked to me. And because Walter was a judge, and I used it whenever I could, it made a newsworthy story. So she wrote it up, and I don't know whether it was the New York Times or what, and somebody, a producer for Phil Donahue, read it. So they got in touch with me, and then there was a nun who was also there named Carol Neuberger from Minnesota, and the two of us were on the Phil Donahue show. And some of Walter's cousins in Wisconsin saw it, and what they said they liked the most was what I said about Walter, of course, which was that he encouraged me all the time to do what I was doing. So then we got gobs of mail, and Wham got a lot of memberships out of that because it was seen all over the country. So that was that.
But your experience on the show itself, positive, negative?
Oh, it was fine. It was fine. The Donahue was great, you know. He was sympathetic, and I think I did well. I get a little, you know, I have a little stage fright when I talk, but on television I usually don't. I just forget and just talk. So it went fine. It went just fine.
Another thing that we had talked about is let's see, I want to just make sure I get this in the right. I'm going to jump around here a little bit, I guess. The Iraq Committee. We talked about the Iraq Committee, and I think were you saying that that it wasn't something about the Iraq Committee. It's a committee of Wham, right?
Right, right.
And is it something that you feel is doing a good job, or?
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder what we talked about. I don't know. We talked about, I'd asked the question, why there are no other Whams, you know, in other parts of the country, or nothing this.
Well, if we had, if we had had the wife of a senator that got interested in this, or somebody that had real political clout and that could attract media attention, I think maybe we could have done it to get more money, to have made it a national organization. Now there is a national women's organization called Code Pink, and it's national. It does not do what Wham does, nor is it as radical. So they say things like, oh, let's be positive. Let's not talk anti-war. Let's talk pro-peace. Wham does not say that. We say we are anti-war. Yes, we're for peace, but everybody's for peace. People that go to war say they go to war for peace. So we don't soft-pedal things. So if there were people, if we ever found a group of women that were willing to work on it, they could do it. But now I was in San Francisco and I looked up a few women out there whose names I'd been given. You just have to have the right combination. And that's, I think I told you, that's why I love Minnesota. Because the people are here. And I think I told you in that tape that I did reading for the blind. Mm-hmm. And that when I had to take lessons to learn how to read. I told you that, didn't I?
Yes.
How it seemed so stupid to me. And they would tell me what to do with if there was a chart, what to do with the chart, and what to do with a prologue, and what to do with the ending, and what to do at the end of the chapter, and footnotes, everything. It was told. And it was several weeks. Not every day, but then I had several sessions that I had to attend, and I thought it was stupid. And then I listened to a tape that was done from someplace else. I listened to a tape that was done from people that had been trained in Minnesota as opposed to, let's say, Indiana. And the work done here was so good because I could just visualize the difference when a blind person was listening to it, that there's a consistency to it, uh-huh. And it was so much better. And this is what I've seen. Now, I would like to have been an academic probably, and that's in my head, and yet I'm always conflicted about it, because at the same time I really get annoyed with them, because they're so picayune-ish, they're so detailed, you know, a real scholar is just, you know, and I get irritated with them, but then I hear somebody give a lecture that is really well-versed on their subject matter. And it's like hearing a symphony to me.
Uh-huh.
I heard a man the other day, an African talk on the situation in the Middle East. And I'm gonna call it now, as a result of his lecture, I'm not calling it the conflict, I'm calling it the Palestinian persecution.
Okay.
He said, when people speak of the conflict, it immediately makes you think about two sides. The two sides, the Arabs and the Zionists, and that isn't the case at all. The case is that there's one side that's being totally persecuted, being stepped on, being harassed, murdered. And so we should use words that convey that. So I listened to him, but he was brilliant. He was a South African, a black man, but a very light-skinned black man. Gorgeous selection of words. I just listened to him and I thought, I would love to be able to have that flow, that precise manner of speaking. It was just, I was entranced with it. And his analysis was such that I learned two things that I've been involved in this issue forever. The apartheid system in South Africa, the way the black Africans were treated by the white South African government, was not as bad as what's going on in Palestine and Israel. And he's pointed this out, and I know that this is true, because the white South Africans never intended to eliminate the black South Africans. It was never their purpose to take over their land, to totally get rid of them. They wanted to get all their land, get everything they could, but that was not, there was not a grand scheme.
Right.
There is in Israel to eliminate all the Palestinians any way they can. Send them to Jordan, send them to Lebanon, or kill them. And then he said the other thing was that there were relationships between the black, the white South Africans and the blacks, the same as there is in the South. That while there was no equality, that certainly in my growing up in the South, we were never to be nasty to black people. You were never to be hateful or mean. And you respected a person and you didn't take advantage of them. But of course they weren't your equals. It was not equal. It was kind of like children, you know. You were good to those people. So he said that also the Zionists who call the Arabs pigs and dogs, and they have an absolute policy of discrimination and hate almost. So that, and this man gave this message, but not as I did, very precise, and everybody was just thrilled to death with it, with his presentation. So what else?
We had also talked about women work in welfare, your work with that.
With that group.
Can you
summarize
that at all, or why you got into it, or what you got out of it?
Well, I'm trying to remember how I got involved in it. But you see, if my mother had not had my grandmother, my grandfather, and they had not been well fixed, not rich, but certainly, and they had not made a home for my mother and my sister and me, my mother would have been like one of these welfare women, because she did not have the education. But back then, there was no program for single mothers. And in the South, I do think that it was due to the fact that there were so many black women that would be in the same position, there was no way there was going to be any kind of program. So I really kind of identified with those women and their plight. And so I don't know how I got started with that group, but I did. And more and more, I began to see different things. For example, they talked about one of the women, and I thought this was really far out, and then I began thinking about it. She said, why should they have to go to work if you had two or three kids? Why shouldn't the government just give you enough money so you didn't have to take up a job and work at it if you were taking care of the kids? So that seemed, pretty bizarre. But if she had a husband that had money, there'd be no question. It wasn't for her character that she should work. It was just the situation. And, the one group I got involved with, and there were some, one in particular, unsavory character, who actually did steal from the organization. But I did meet and still see some of these women. I've run into them once in a while, and some of them have done very well, and some of them are still having a terrible time just making ends meet.
What did you basically do with that organization? What kinds of work did you do?
Well, what would I do?
Serve on some kind of committee or
well,
something?
Well, I would, and I would, if they had a demonstration, I would speak and write letters to the editor and go to the to the Capitol with them, and because they needed to have women who were middle class with them, and it gave them strength. It didn't give them strength. It gave them a validity. I wasn't the only one. For example, there's a bunch of nuns who also do the same thing, and actually, their organization, there's a woman that runs this welfare rights group. That's one of the best groups I know. She gets no money whatsoever, and she cleans house for a living. But she runs that organization like a tight ship. And whenever they go places for demonstration, they have a bus that takes the women there, and there's food. And, well, I know one thing I did do, Mike, that I think, because I think I was effective. I think that I really helped them get money from other women's organizations that I knew about. I'd write letters and in support, and I think it did help. Mostly those women are not educated. That's the problem. And my friend Carol Hogard, who's married to Eddie Feline, teaches at the Minnesota, Hennepin Community College. And before that so-called welfare reform, they had money to go to college. And she would have these women in her classes, and they would get a degree and they would go to work. And now, since the welfare reform with Clinton, the great Democrat, their funds were cut, and all those programs, and they can't go to school, so they just have to sit there. Now, my cousin, Gloria Louise, who had, I think, 11 kids, you know, the one that went home to live with her, with Nan, she was in the same position as my mother, and there was Nan, it brought, and they took her in, and she graduated from high school, and she got married. She got her GED, and for 4 years with all those kids lived with Nan, and got a job, took care of the kids. She, in the meantime, at one point, I think after, she met a man, and she married him. This is interesting. He had a bunch of kids. She moved out east with him. He was an engineer or something. He had a pretty good job. And she lived out there for maybe a year or two, and then he molested her daughter sexually. She went to the priest, and the priest said, you know, men are like that. You just bear with this.
Oh my gosh.
That's what he told her.
Wow.
So she left him and came home. I don't know what she probably.
This is Nan.
Nan's daughter.
Okay.
Nan's daughter. And this is Nan's son is Donald, who is still a friend of Scott's.
Okay.
Because when Barbara, my sister, Ma'oniha, they're friends.
I'd written down Eugene McCarthy's office.
Oh.
I wonder what we were talking about.
Well,
letters to the editor, Eugene McCarthy's office.
I supported McCarthy, and you know, I was that, and I've got a whole, you know, I read that stuff. I've got a whole file over there on the 68 convention. When I was, he asked me, my friend Rose just went. She was married, I'm sure Rose is dead, married to a doctor. She was from Hastings. And she was going to Chicago and to work for McCarthy. And so when I say work for him, that meant try to get as many delegates to support him as possible. We were not delegates. We just went. And she's the woman, I've written this up. We got in a hotel, and we got early in Chicago, got rooms at the Hilton Hotel, she and I.
Oh, yes.
And then they tried to put us out, and she said that she was having an attack. I told you that.
Yeah.
And then they were afraid to put her out of friends, so we stayed in our room. And then Tom Tiffany was there, who had come with us, who's a son, who's from Redwood Falls. And he couldn't get back out to the man that he was staying with, the young man he was staying with, so he stayed in the room with us. So there were three of us in this little tiny room. And then we were in the streets, and we got gassed, and...
I remember you were saying there was this demonstrations in this park, and you
yeah.
thought you had to go down there, I think, or...
Yeah, well, I, I don't know why I wasn't out there. And Rose said, you've got to get out there. That's where it's going on. And so I went out there. And so that's when Jean Genet, the writer, was there. Norman Mailer was there. Dave Dellinger was there. They were all in the park talking. And it was a beautiful day. And I think Mailer was, Dave Dellinger had a pig. And talking about the police, of course. Okay. And then at one point, there was a real skinny little man, small, that put a flag up on, which was a red flag of anarchy. And then the police attacked with tear gas, and they came into the crowd. And I think I told you that I picked up with about three priests on the way in, and I thought, if I get on the news, it'll be okay. I'll be surrounded by these priests, and it'll be look okay. So I sat there with these priests, and we visited. And while we were in the park, I think I told you, I looked up, and on the buildings around the park, there were soldiers with guns trained on us. And that was kind of an eerie feeling. And I thought, my gosh, you know, what have we done that they would have those guns trained on us? And then that night, we walked in a march. And I'm wondering if I think Dick Gregory was in the march. And we walked along, and there were what were called the P. Blackstone Rangers. It was a group of black doing all kinds of gymnastics. Oh, there was another thing about that. Early in the march, there are so many moving things that happen. I mean, if you, so many moving things that just, at one point, a bakery truck stopped. And they pulled out loaves of bread, and they passed that bread. And I thought, this is communion. The people who had been there hadn't had food all day long. And that was so solidifying. That was such a moment. It was just, you know, a moment in space and time that I looked and I thought, and these are people who really are here. There was no question in my mind that they were out there protesting for the right to live and for good things. And everything that was said verified this in my mind. Every speech, there was nothing that I saw on the part of the people who were protesting that was ugly or violent. I did not see it. Now, no doubt there were things there, but I didn't see it. And I think I told you there was a man there. I was walking along, and you'd be walking along, there'd be people come up, and you'd talk to them, and then you'd walk along here. And this was he probably maybe 30 years old with two little kids. What, did he have them with him? I'm trying to remember, don't remember. But he told me that he was not, I said, what are you doing here? He said, I work in Chicago. He said, I saw this on the paper, on the TV, and he said, I've got kids. And he said, I'm not part of this, but this is wrong. And I just had to get out here. And so there were people like that were there. And it was really a wonderful experience. It was frightening because and I think I told you that we stopped and we were walking along. This was at nighttime, at night. And then we saw the police stop, and they put on their
goggles or?
No, their face, their
face mask.
Yeah, so we knew we were gonna get gassed.
Okay.
And so we were. That gas really, really, it's tough. And we had been given little pieces of wet cloth, and they said to put them up to your nose. So then we all dispersed, and there was a church and a vacant lot, and the police were coming this way. And so I walked into this vacant lot. It was dark, and I thought, well, I'll just stand here. And there was a man by me. And then we saw the police come with a couple of boys. I think they were black boys, and as those, and they were kids, they had their batons out and they were hitting their feet as they, and it was so brutal. And I started out and the man said, you really don't want to go out there. He said, they're going to hit you in the head. You're not going to do any good. Just stay here. And I did. I did. But I should have gone. See, I know. It just, you think you'll be a hero, then when it gets right down to it, you're not. You're not. So, and then when we went back to the hotel, there were so many, it's kind of like a blur in my mind now, but there were so many casualties because the police had been so brutal. And so they had set up on the floor where McCarthy was staying, they had set up a kind of a clinic to treat those people. And they were bandaging them and so forth and so on. And when you walked into the Hilton Hotel, the tear gas just, the smell of it was just everywhere. So it was Benham and it was a riot, but it was the police. And I can remember one time I was right in front of the hotel and the police came with sawhorses and pushing me right into the hotel, pushing me right against the wall. They didn't care. They didn't care.
Let me just stop here for a moment. Okay, I think now also when I wrote Eugene McCarthy's office, I think what I remember is you told the story about going to Chicago, not during that time, but as part of the campaign, and how you, another woman, went to Gary, Indiana.
Oh, yeah, that was, yeah.
And how, I think, disappointed you were about how it was organized.
Oh, right, that was during, before the convention, that was when we were getting support for McCarthy, and garnering support, forgotten just how that was, in various places, and I was sent to Gary, and I know what I was doing there. I was organizing for Mrs. McCarthy was going to come and give a speech there, and so I was there helping to set up this talk that she was going to give. I did not like her. I did not, and so I stayed in this hotel. And I met these people that were working for McCarthy. And one of them was a man named Tony Podesta. I think I told you that. He has a brother that was working still in Washington. And Barbara met him later, and I think they had a little thing going, and I did not understand that, but that was one of those things. They were impossible. They were arrogant. And I watched them, and there was a storefront. They had a storefront campaign office, and they people would. It was in a Latino neighborhood, and people would come in, and these people would be kind of in the back, and nobody to talk to them. But they were supposed to be garnering support for McCarthy. They wouldn't talk to them, and they did not like me, and I did not like them, and. I think I got so fed up with them that I finally either called or I wrote McCarthy, and I think he got rid of some of them eventually. But then I think I told you that I was at the hotel and I finally left. I just said I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't work with these people, but I wrote a letter to the editor the last day. Because I met so many wonderful people in Gary. I met some wonderful black people, marvelous, some wonderful Jewish people they were marvelous, marvelous people. And I wrote the letter saying how great it was, how happy I was to have met them, and that the one thing I thought the campaign had accomplished was that as a result of McCarthy, some of these black people and Jewish people got together and knew that they were on the same side and were going to work together. So when I was writing the letter, one of the women that worked in the hotel came in to talk to me, one of the clerks, and she said, what are you doing? I said, well, I borrowed their typewriter. I said, I'm writing this letter, and I said, I'm leaving. And then I said, I'm just disgusted with what's going on. And then she said, yes, she said they were, I think I told you that, the staff was very disappointed with them because they were rude to the staff and they were sleeping around all over the place with each other. And they, you know, people just generally don't look easy on those things.
Right.
So, anyhow, it was very interesting. I had one night when I was in Gary, I was with they had a black mayor, I think. I was the only white person in this whole room of black people. And it was okay. It was interesting.
Switching subjects here.
Yes.
I have a note here, women in South America. I wonder what that was about. Women in South America.
Women in South America. What about the women in South America? Let me think about that, because
I think that's one of those we're going to just have to skip. I don't know what it might have been about.
Well, no, I don't know either.
Something about, and I wrote women versus men.
In South America?
No, I don't know. Okay.
Okay.
About, you know, how you started reading as a young person and enjoying reading. When did you start writing? What was your first letter to the editor?
I started writing. I joined when I was in high school. It was called Opera Creata, Creative Works. It was a little writing class in high school. And I don't know. I think it was pretty gradual. I just think that I decided gradually that I don't think it was any big illumination nor do I think anybody ever said you're a great writer. I don't think anybody ever, I got any great encouragement. I just began writing. When I was in South America, I did a lot of writing, and I thought maybe I could get it about being there, because it was, you know, quite an adventure. But there wasn't any, I think I tried to have it printed, but there was not any great interest in it, in my writing. And
what's the earliest recollection of a letter to the editor, or what do you remember writing about? I suppose it would have been in Wyndham, when you started working?
Oh, when in Wyndham, I wrote a column for the newspaper called Through My Kitchen Window.
Interesting. Do you have any copies of anything?
It's terrible. There's some in that. They're awful. Yeah, they're really, really bad. Really bad.
But so, they'd be funny. Funny to...
Yeah, well, it was, yeah. And because I've changed so over the years and what I wrote about.
Okay, well, what did you write about through your kitchen window?
Oh, about what was going on in Wyndham, and nobody knew who wrote it. It was just...
Didn't sign it? Your name
no,
was
no,
not?
No, no, no. It was just a little column. But I knew the editor of the newspaper there, and he printed it. So,
my kitchen window.
Through the kitchen window. Maybe it was through my kitchen window, I guess it was. Yeah, corny. They were terrible. Terrible. Pretty terrible.
Well, you say they were terrible. They were, you wrote about everyday mundane things.
Yes, right. Well, and when I say terrible, I think that my interests were so much different then, and that's why I think I've changed so much over the years as to what is important and unimportant to me, and that I was writing about what my life was then, and it was important.
And when you moved to Marshall, I think you also had a column in the paper there?
No.
No, never.
No, that paper didn't like me.
Okay. All right. So you...
And did I write there? No, I don't think so.
Now, when you moved out into the country, you started writing.
Right, and I did write. I did write in the Marshall, and I told you. Well, Hubalella is a play. I still think it's a funny play. And Ubilella was a combination that was sent of Hubert Humphrey and Cinderella. Hubert Humphrey was Cinderella. And she, how did that go? Because, and then I had McCarthy in it. He was called Macrofit. And Ubilella, how did that go? She was Ubilella, instead of, she was the widow of a king who died. And she was, there was going to be somebody else, the king's hateful nephew or somebody, was looking for a bride. And then the old Cinderella myth came into it. And Ubilella, who was Humphrey, was trying to be the bride to marry this Macrofit. I've forgotten who it was, but it was like Humphrey trying to get to be the president. And I think it's kind of funny. I think it's kind of funny. I think especially if you know the connotation. And I don't know if you know it, but the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas were all political, and they were written about real people. That most people who hear the operas never know that. There was a song about a cat, carefully on tiptoe, stealing, creeping gently as we may, every step with caution feeling, we will softly steal away. Goodness me, why, what was that? Silent bee, it was the cat. Well, the cat was a political figure in England at the time. So I didn't know this when I wrote it. It was just that it came to me. And but I to ever get anything like that done, you have to really be you have to immerse yourself in it. And I read about, who did I read about? Emma Goldman, I think it was, who was a famous political character, communist, and it was said that she could have been a literary critic, but she never stuck to it. She was too involved in her politics, and I never studied or equipped myself really. I did take writing classes, but I never really devoted myself to doing it, to being perfecting the craft, because writing's a craft.
You wrote, I'm guessing, to express yourself.
Right, and that's what distinguishes me from what I call a real writer. A real writer, I think, when I say a real writer, I mean a gifted writer, as Josh is a gifted artist, has this need to really draw word pictures, to really capture the essence of a landscape, or sitting here to get the feeling of the sun and the brightness of the sun on that building down there, how it's so brilliant. And I never write like that. That's not my purpose. I've got a message, see, I'm like, and so the message has always been much more important to me than the words. And so that, as a matter of fact, writers are kind of dismissive of that kind of writing. That's not a real writer. And so, I mean, that's just it.
When you're talking, I'm thinking of another way of looking at it would be to say that you write out of your own personality. I think perhaps you could say that maybe the best writers, writing is more transcendent. You don't read their personalities as you read their writing. You're reading something that seems timeless, or
yes, right.
From any perspective, anywhere, at any time, almost. Or
yes.
Just,
oh, exactly, or, exactly.
So, and when you moved out of the country is when you wrote Princess Fay, right? Isn't that when you wrote Princess Fay?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, oh, I wrote. I wrote.
That's the only thing you wrote.
No, and then I wrote the book about Melinda, which you read. What did I call it? I know that my friend, who was my writing teacher, made some changes in it. I'm not sure they were good.
If I read it, which I probably did, I certainly have forgotten it.
You did. And your comment to me was, because I remember, it was a story of the Vietnam years and the death of Melinda, really. Well, not really, but it was. And I'd made it the three daughters, and you said to me, it was really interesting to read it when I wasn't in it, and you weren't in it, you see, because I left you out, because you weren't really a part of that death.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? I mean, you were young, and that whole scene with Melinda and her involvement in the things that were going on, you were not much, as much a part of that, those Vietnam years. You were so much younger.
Okay.
Am I wrong? Maybe I am wrong.
So.
Huh? You think so?
I would say so.
But I thought I had hurt you. I felt I had really hurt you by not...
Oh, by not including me.
Yeah, but not including
you. I think I do remember that, and I think you, at the time, I did feel hurt.
Yes, yeah. that I had not put you in there.
Yeah. But that was, again, that was just...
Well, yes, well, I really...
That's just where I was at the time.
Well, I wrote it, really, it was catharsis.
Right.
It was real catharsis.
Right. Yeah.
And it did help me. And I think... What did I call it to begin with? The years of... the years, I think it was the years of something. It wasn't desperation, but it was something like that.
So, let's talk about writing. So then you also write for the Wham newsletter.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything you write has a purpose.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah,
and
I seldom.
Very seldom is something written just to write or just to.
Because I feel just to
or
to describe something. Even the poems that I've written have not been that. But I think you've written the other way, haven't you?
Yeah, I get a kick out of writing just to write.
What?
Yeah, I don't care what.
You just
probably,
want to write.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably the way it is. You know, it's not real complimentary, but that's all right. So now what are you writing about recently? You're still writing for the Wham. You're writing
about
the Palestinians.
Yeah, and then I'm really trying to get Princess Faye, I'm not writing, but I'm trying to get a reading of it done. And then I did rewrite, I wrote this play about Victoria Woodhull, who ran for president, because I kind of identified with her. And then I wrote a three-woman, and then I took it and I wrote a three-woman play out of the major play. And I know women's group here, and they said they might be interested in doing it. And lately I've been thinking I'm going to send that version of it to another woman that I know, because she could play the part. So what I did with it, it is Victoria and her mother and her sister there. And these are not really respectable women, none of them. They're more than renegades. And so they come on stage and they talk to each other. They're dressed in the clothing of the past. And then somebody, it's kind of mixed up. Somebody from the audience heckles them. And then they respond and say, well, you don't know what it was like. You should have been there. And so they talk back and forth about what it was like and how how they were the most talked about women they were at their time. At the time, these women for 5 years put out a newspaper which was the most discussed newspaper in the country, and the history books don't carry a word about them. And Victoria ran for president 5 times before women even had the vote. There's not a word about her in the history books.
Wow.
The only people who know about her are those who study women's history, women's studies. And the reason is because, as I say, she was a stockbroker, and she was also a medium, and she was not too virtuous. But she took care of her husband, who was an alcoholic, and he lived in the house with her when she was married, so-called, but there's a question about it, to another man. But she had many things that went on with her that I admired. She was good to people and so forth. So her mother got mad at her one time and went to the police about her and said she was living in sin there with these two men. And the kind of people that, but on the other hand, she was good to people. And as I say, she was good to her alcoholic husband, and she had a big family and she took care of them. And they made money. It's really a fascinating story. They were mediums,
right.
So they talked to these businessmen and got information from them as they would talk to them. And then they'd make money on the stock market. And then the one sister was the mistress of, you've heard of Vanderbilt, Cornelius Vanderbilt, very famous, very rich man, was the mistress of Cornelius Vanderbilt. That was the one named Tennessee. And she would get information, they would get information from these men and use it. And they were very wealthy for a while. And then, And Victoria ran for president. Oh, I was going to tell you the funny thing she said. That was really funny. Was that when she ran for president, Susan B. Anthony, the famous suffragist, supported her. And so some of the men in the Congress came to Susan B. Anthony and said to her, "This is a very notorious woman. You really should not be supporting her." And this is according to the book. Susan B. Anthony said, "Boys, go back and clean up your own act. And when you do with the men, then I'll consider what you're saying." Which, for those times, you know, you think it sounds pretty modern, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it was that. So that's what got me interested in this story. I can't believe it, and in the end, it's like a soap opera. I cannot believe, if I had the right connections, there would have been a serial on TV, because in the end, it had a happy ending. Victoria met a British, he was from the banking industry and owned banks, and he fell in love with her, and he married her, and she became respectable. And entertain the Prince of Wales at dinner. Can you believe that?
Oh,
and people kind of forgave her past. And she ended up buying some property that had been in the family of George Washington and set up a memorial to George Washington. Her sister married a marquis or somebody like that and lived in a castle.
Huh.
So I just got entranced with this whole story of these two women. So that's it. It's something that it's something that captures your interest for me, and then I write about it. Unless it does, I'm not just interested in writing about anything. If you ask me to write, I don't know, I have to get interested in it.
But that particular story, I would say, it doesn't sound like you have any particular purpose other than you enjoyed her story, and it might be inspirational, but beyond that, there's no political message necessarily. I mean, there is one, but it's not.
No, not really. Yeah, it was, no, not really. Not really. That she persisted. Yeah, no, I guess it would be the struggle of women, but that's not really.
And you did say you identified with her.
Yeah, I identified with her in that she kind of, she stood up for what she believed in. And people didn't stop her. She did what she thought was the thing to do. I might not have agreed with it, but she did, and she had tenacity to go at it, which is something I just developed. I don't think that, you know, she started when she was about 14 years old. She was married. So it's interesting. So what else did I write? Let's see. And I wrote that short story about, and I've written some other short stories, but I forgot now.
A lot of letters to the editor.
Yeah, and I've written poetry, and I wrote all that Vietnam poetry, gobs of Vietnam poetry, about, that I took from the
books that you read.
From the stories that of the men themselves who told me what they had been through, you know, like the one where the man who told me about, he was in a bar one night and there was a fight, and I don't know why, it just interested me. And this one man got drunk and bit off another man's ear. I don't know. That was so bizarre, I couldn't believe it. Bit it off. So that. And I have written other poetry, but it all. I'm not a poet either, so.
I think we'll stop.